All right.
Feedback.
Good morning and welcome to the Burning Platform Live this Thursday morning at 7 o'clock. I've got Pumi in the studio in Johannesburg, and I am in my studio, and we're going to be talking about independent candidates this morning. We'll be joined by Anele Mda, who is one of the more well-known of our independent candidates, and we'll be talking to her about exactly what that means. We'll also discuss some of the latest developments in terms of the parties, where they're going, what they're up to, and all of that stuff, which will be happening through the course of this hour. Pums, can you hear us over there? You got us all sorted? No. Okay. All right. Well, while they mess around in the studio and try to get things together, let me get Anele on stage. Hello, Anele Mda. How are you?
Good morning, Gareth. Good morning to Mpumi and the team, and a very good morning to you, to listeners at home as well. I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. It's good to see you. So, Anele, you're one of the more well-known of our independent candidates. It's a brave thing to do, first election that you can actually run in as an independent. Tell us a little bit about what got you to this point.
You know, Gareth, the thing about South Africa is that we are a country of euphoria in so many respects. And there's so many things that South Africans do that makes, you know, every day when you wake up, you feel like we're such a country of great potential. But then there gets to be a point where you ask yourself, at what point are we going to get this potential fully realized in our country? And us being able to get to that point where we feel as though we are really making strides that are, you know, not just recognizable amongst ourselves as South Africans, but strides that are able to, you know, transcend into this greatness that we always feel like we're waiting for. And for me, 30 years into our democracy was a very long time of having to do a great reflection of where are we as the country. And I couldn't help but, you know, feel as though there is some regressive progressivism that we are doing that is taking us nowhere slowly. And I think I can attribute that to the decaying of leadership, especially in public office. But over and above that, there is a sense of, you know, sanitization of, you know, active citizenry that is just driving people of South Africa into this state of complacency where they act as though they don't see the things that are going wrong.
Anele, I just want to stop you there because you said something about regressive progressivism. What do you mean by that?
I mean, a sense of progress that we know, that we're conscious of, but it is going at a regressive backwards rather than going forward as we want to see. So you are more having, you know, people in office that you can't put your finger on what exactly are they busy with that is about the country, except to say you recognize that they are indeed in office. But are they served with the duties that are supposed to take this country forward, or are they just holding office for the sake of having people in office?
I think you've hit the nail on the head, and including a lot of the people that we see on TV all the time, getting lots of attention, being paid big salaries, and not doing anything for the country. Doing quite a lot for themselves. Pumi, can you hear us now? Are you back on? No.
No, can you hear me now?
You can, go ahead.
But big feedback. Anele, I love that phrase, and I'm probably going to use it because it's definitely firing shots. But okay, so what about you? What is it that you think that you can bring to the environment that you can, if you get in, will bring to parliament that you think you can shift as an independent candidate?
Thank you, Pumi. Firstly, I'm not a conformist. I bow to no one. I'm not a conveyor belt. I'm not a captured. I'm not a person who depends on towing the line. I tow no one's line. I tow the citizen's line. And I believe that my militancy and my progressive radicalism, I'm very unapologetic about it. And I'm not one of those South Africans who are always trying to fit in, who are always trying to, I don't want to offend. I am always wanting to offend, because if we do not want to offend the status quo, we're not going to get anything done. People that are serving people of South Africa, people that are in office to serve citizens, shouldn't be made to sit comfortably in this place of cushion, because we, instead of according them respect, we've become more fearful of them, because all of a sudden they are now defined along the lines of status on the pedestal of just coming to public office to serve people. And that is what I bring. I bring a fresh perspective of grassroots accountability that is unapologetic in its posture, but that's very radical and aggressive. Because if we continue with this element of praising and worshiping politicians and public office bearers, we are failing our own selves. Because when we smile and take photos with people that are eating our money in such a dishonorable way, what are we doing? We are mocking our own selves. And I'm saying we need to break away from the norm. These people must be in office, and I am putting myself there now. I'm saying I must be part of the... Yes, Gareth?
Sorry. Anela, I do want us to focus on you, and while I'm sympathetic to the idea of people eating our money and smiling in photographs, what is it that you stand for? Because as an independent, your message has to be very clear. You don't have party funding behind you. You don't have all the machinery that the ANC, the EFF, the DA have behind them. You have to do it all yourself. So what do you, if you could tell people in South Africa three things that you stand for, what are they?
Firstly, I stand for accountability. Accountability from public office for me is a big thing. And it is a priority area, because how we've gotten where we are, it is as a result of having citizens of South Africa being passive players into the state of the running of the affairs of the government, which have effectively pushed the most critical stakeholder, which is the citizens, to the periphery. That is the first thing. Secondly, I stand for a corrupt-free public service, which at the core of it, I believe that corruption does not just enrich politicians. It takes away and steals the future of so many people of our country. Because when we have deepened corruption in the public service the way we have, we end up having a situation where we prioritize in budgeting bailouts of state-owned enterprises that have been brought to their knees and that have been rendered to be cash-strapped and financially bankrupt as a result of the corruption that is happening. So my proposal on fighting corruption, amongst other things, is to ensure that we do away with the tender system. It is a bold move. It is an unpopular move, but it's a necessary move. Doing away with a tender system will mean that we level the field, because we open the space for merit-based business engagement with government, where businesses will engage and offer services to government, not on the basis of political connection, but rather on the basis of the merit that their businesses have got expertise to offer. And also, all the people that run businesses that have got an opportunity, using their profile, of course, that have got an opportunity to do business with government, can be able to do so. And it will not only be the few elitists that is linked to politicians. The third one, which is most important for me in addressing the high youth unemployment, is having a mandatory 3-year internships that will replace the current system that we have in ensuring that young people are able to accumulate workplace experience. The 3 years that I'm proposing will be broken into in this way. The first year will be in-service work training, which will ensure that a young person who is a graduate, who is fresh from university, who has not been exposed in a workplace, will get an opportunity of being exposed in a workplace and get the ropes. On the second and the third year, it will be the workplace experience accumulation, which grants them the 2-year standard experience that is required when people are looking for a job. And that means we will be addressing the unemployment at that point in time, not this thing of rendering, using internships as a way of keeping young people outside of employment margins. So those are the three fundamental things amongst many that I know I am pushing for and I'm proposing, and I'm very committed and resolved on driving them.
All right.
Anela, can I ask you this? Maybe if you can just give us a picture of who you are. You know, we are so used to voting for a party because up until now, there have been no independent candidates. And the experience that we've had is that within the party, they have done their vetting. They know who these people are, what they can do. But as an independent candidate, none of us know you. There are many people who have probably never even seen or heard you. And so who are you? Where do you come from? And why now?
All right. I am a South African born in a place called Bizana. It's a small town in the Eastern Cape. I grew up there, and I originally emerged from the Eastern Cape. I became politically active at a young age of 13, between the ages of 12 and 13. And I've been a social and a gender activist. My activism was shaped by conditions at the time of the province of the Eastern Cape, where I come from, where I've been exposed, and where I started both my political activism and also my social activism as a citizen. And over and above that, at the age of 17, I established an NGO in the place of Port St. John's, where I was in high school. This was a responsive mechanism that I established to deal with the issue of HIV/AIDS at the time, which was at proportionately high infections that had gotten to a state where stigmatization around people that were infected by HIV were isolated. And the lack of information from the communities at the time, drove families into a state of despair where infected people or suspicious people that were seen to be maybe having signs and symptoms of HIV, of being HIV positive, were locked in isolation and all those kind of things. And there was no form of support for families. There was no form of information and awareness that was being driven from a point of Department of Health. And it was on that basis that I established that NGO. That NGO ran for a good 6 years, up to a point where I opened an HIV/AIDS information center in Port St. John's, which was to be a one-stop shop both for the local communities, but also for health officials to be able to use us as a center of sharing information and be able to conduct a pre and post testing and counseling for people. But over and above that, I cut my teeth in politics whilst I was in high school, being a part of COSAS, which was an ANC aligned student movement at a high school level. And I've gone to be active in the ANC. Like I said, I was born in politics. I was introduced to politics by my grandfather, who has worked very closely with the late president of the ANC, Oliver Tambo, at the time. And I've led in the ANC, in the ANC Youth League, and I was amongst the people that established COPE when we felt that the ANC had left the reins that we have known of its principles. And in 2008, I was amongst the founding members of the Congress of the People. And when we contested elections then, I went to become a member of parliament representing COPE in 2009, when COPE was entangled in the leadership squabble. And at the time I was a member of parliament, I decided that I will no longer be able to continue, because it was now self-focused and self-consumed. It was no longer about serving the people of South Africa who had sent us to parliament. So I resigned and left parliament with all the perks that comes with being a member of parliament and the benefits that are attached to it. My conscience led me out, because it was no longer about the good cause that we had agitated for at the time. So I left parliament, and out of parliament, I went to corporate. I worked in corporate for a good 6-7 years. But at that time, I was continuing being a person who is a global speaker. I've spoken to many different countries and in different pedestals with different figures. But more than anything, my call to serve has always been on the activism side, whether it's on social, gender, political. It's always about there's always that strong pursuit of social justice in my activism, and that's what has defined me over the years. That's just who I am. That's not in totality who I am, but that's just part of who I am.
But why, you know, it's such an expensive exercise to try and get to parliament. Why not continue working with the people on the ground? Why not be a councillor? Why not be a mayor? Why be so far away in parliament?
But what's wrong with being in parliament? What's different between being a councillor and being in parliament? Because the councillor is a lawmaker, a parliamentarian is a lawmaker. So what distinguishes the need for you to think, I must rather seek to become a councillor rather than becoming an MP? What's wrong with going back to where I have been? Because I'm not coming to parliament as a newcomer. I'm going back to parliament to continue the work that I started at in 2009 and over and above that. What's not serving the people of South Africa by being an MP? That would be about serving the people of South Africa by being a councillor.
I think it's not a
question that says one is better or wrong than the other. My question is, why would you choose to go to parliament and not work closer to the people? This is about us trying to understand your motivation.
Yeah, I'm trying to crystallize your question so that I understand exactly what about being in parliament is not closer to the people, that is closer when you are a councillor. I'm trying to you to lead me to the distinction because. Come again.
What is for you that motivates wanting to be in parliament?
Like I said, I've been in parliament. I understand being a lawmaker. I understand strides that are needed to be made and the impact that I know I am best fit to make. And parliament is that space for me. And also, I do not think that there should be terrains that are exclusively selected who should go to those terrains and who should not. I believe that understanding what the challenges South Africa is facing at this current juncture and identifying strategic places where one feels as though they will be able to go and make an impact on me having identified parliament is on the basis of not only my attributes that I believe will match what is required in parliament. I think also it is that understanding of the fact that there is a need to drive an active kind of parliament that is very much drawn closer to the people. And I think independent candidates are a deliberate conduit that the constitutional
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Angela, I don't mean to keep interrupting you, but we've got an interesting comment here. And I think this cuts to the chase. Someone here says, will you get enough votes to get a seat in parliament? Because everything you're saying depends on that. And it's hard. As I said just now, I mean, you have my sympathies as an independent. You have to do a lot of hard work to get that seat, 38,000 votes or something, right?
Obviously, Gareth, you capture it very correctly. It's not an easy and it's not all a smooth sailing kind of a terrain for us as independent candidates. But the most important thing for me is that understanding that parliament is an assemble of a contestation of ideas where we have to sharpen the way in which we all should be fighting for taking South Africa forward. So it does go without saying that at my arrival in parliament, I'll obviously have to identify much more concerted efforts that I will have to maximize in ensuring that I am able to make the necessary impact that I'm there to make. But over and above that, I do not want really to confine myself into the preoccupation of thinking that there is something lesser about the impact that I may want to make, which will not be able to find expression on the basis of the fact that I will be a lone member. I will be a lone member in as far as being an independent candidate, but the measure of effectiveness in parliament is not driven from a point of how many are you. It's rather driven by the extent of the direct commitment and resolve that you have on issues that you have identified as pertinent to you. I mean, as we speak right now in South Africa, we've got the bill that legalized Dacha to be used for medicinal purposes. That bill was sponsored as a private member's bill by a member of IFP, the late Ambrose Sini. That tells you, I mean, he came from the benches of the opposition parties at the time, but he was able to sponsor a private member's bill that started from the House as far as programming unit up until it was adopted by the National Assembly to get it signed by the president. He didn't have to come from the ruling party. He didn't have to come from anywhere as a party that is strategically influential. It was driven by his own personal resolve that he was very clear that he wants this to emerge, and it did emerge. So that is where I take the experience that says the measure of effectiveness may not necessarily be lying only on the numerical ability of being just one person or more than one person. It's about the resolve and the drive.
Anele, but he also came from the fourth biggest party in parliament at the time.
But it was not a party. It was not a party position. It was the private member's bill.
Sorry, you were muted. Please say that again.
I'm saying it was not a party position. It was a private member's bill. So the party being the fourth member, I mean, the fourth biggest party, was immaterial because it was not the IFP position. It was a private member's bill.
Okay, that's fine. Do you think that your campaign has done enough to get you into parliament?
I think the work that I've done over the more than 25 years of being an activist in South Africa speaks for itself. It's well documented. My work has always been grassroots level. I've never been a person who's detached from the people of South Africa. And my grasp of the issues that befall the people of South Africa has always come from the fact that on a daily basis, I interact with South Africans. And I think this campaign of me being an independent candidate was an ultimate culmination of that activism, which I believe is also well documented. And the work that I've done on the campaign itself, I think it being an extension and a continuation of the work of activism that I've done, it suffice for me to say, if I wouldn't have been, I wouldn't have had the support of the people of South Africa, I would not even manage to have gotten to a point where I'm gazetted as an independent candidate. So the support is well displayed.
Speaking of support, how are you funding your campaign?
I'm funding my campaign by myself.
It's quite a, because this is a very big conversation, particularly with some of the new parties that everybody is having, that says, you know, other people putting in money because it's an expensive exercise. Who was on Musi telling us about how much it takes to put up one Correx board? That's a poster. You know, it's very interesting. That there were some of the independent campaign candidates, we know who funds them and how they've been able to get this far. So it's interesting that you have been able to fund this campaign all by yourself. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, the more the merrier. And frankly, Anela, as far as I can tell, like, please, will someone just kill those monitors in the studio that are making me reverberate in my own ears? Thank you. Anela, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show, though, this morning, and I hope we'll be able to talk to you after the election with one seat in Parliament. You're a one-man band. Sometimes we need the people who can make the most noise. And one or two comments here from people who are excited about the fact that you make a noise. They wish you could do it inside a party. Let's see if you can do that outside a party.
Thank you so much, Gareth, for your time. I truly appreciate it. And thank you for the South Africans who have carried me so far. We're going to the ballot on the 29th. I'm on the orange ballot in Gauteng. They must not forget to look for that face that is behind me. Anele Mda, your independent candidate.
Thank you, Anele. Very good to see you. And thanks for being on the show this morning.
Thank you very much for your time. Good luck.
All right. Well, Pums, we've got quite a lot to talk about. We've only got, a week and a half? A little bit of time left for people to still make up.
13 days.
There we go. So it's hardly any time at all. And I think that there are probably a lot of people who thought that the idea of independent candidates might have been a sexy idea at the beginning. We were going to have Zaki Ahmad on this morning as well. His people told us at 11 o'clock last night he can't make it. So if he can't make it for an interview, I wonder if he can make it doing anything more useful than that.
I think one of the things we must do the next 13 days, Gareth, we might have to have a demonstration of how to fold your ballot paper. Because remember, this is a serious thing, and I don't think we've spent enough time talking about it, right? Because you're going to get three ballots. I tried to explain this last night to another group of people that Gareth and I were talking about with Wayne Sussman, and I tried to explain what the three ballot system is and is going to work. And Wayne said, I get 95%. So today, let me try and get 100%. So all of us are going to get three ballots, a right. national ballot, a provincial ballot, and a district. So what are they calling it? Regional ballot, which is going to be for the independent candidates. The national ballot, we know, 52 parties are going to be in there. So it's we've been told that it's going to be a two-column ballot. Mm-hmm. So before you only had one column, one long, and you looked, it's going to be two columns and it's going to be multiple pages. So a little booklet, guys. We must learn how to fold this thing because you have to fold it yourself to get it into the box. Remember that, right? So that's the first one. The second one is for the province. It's for the... What are you laughing at, Gareth?
It's no, for... I'm laughing because...
It's for Panyaza Lusufi. It's for Kenny Kunene. It's Funzi Mubeni. It's for those individuals. Also, it's going to be a long one, but it's not going to be as long as the national one. And then there's the regional ballot. The regional ballot is where your independent candidates are going to be. And that's, and I didn't even know it was going to be orange. So there's an orange ballot. And that's where, so you, everybody gets to pick in all three ballots.
Right.
My biggest worry right now is, and I don't think we've spent enough time talking about it, is spoiled ballots. And how, because we've had spoiled ballots in 94 more than any other time, because there's been so much training, there's been so much educating people on what to do. But this time there hasn't been. So you must be careful. Maybe next week, Gareth, we get, because you've got the IEC contact people.
I will talk to the IEC because I do think that's useful. We have explained before on Democracy 101 exactly what it was that you need to know about these three ballot papers, but you've just done a better job than anyone else because there are three and they do sound complicated. And I wouldn't blame people if they didn't know how to fold them or get them right. I mean, when did we have to have a booklet before? It's because there's all these small Anyana parties, right, who are taking place on the ballot.
Pumlan is saying, do we have to vote on each ballot? What if you want to skip on and just vote on one or two? You absolutely can. It's your prerogative.
Yeah, you don't have to vote on all three. I mean, if you just go in and vote in the national, that's also fine. But I think for a lot of people, it does give them an opportunity to feel like they are, you know, making conscious choices. I mean, I've met a couple of people over the last few days who've said, I'm voting this way nationally, but they want to vote a different way provincially and regionally. And I'm like, I don't really see the point. To my mind, you are?
We spoke about this. We spoke about this with Cantman. I'm splitting my vote. And just one other thing that I also don't think enough has been made about this is the fact that because of these regional ballots, so we know in the past, you have to vote in the province where you are registered. But this right. time around, you actually have to vote at the voting station. And you all know this happened to me when I could only vote for the mayor and not for my councillor, right? Because for whatever reason, my address had been demarcated wrong, right? So we have until tomorrow to check. So go to elections.org, find yourself on the register, see that you just check which is the voting station that you are registered at. If you have moved in the past, whatever, in the past, I think probably past 15 years, right? Because that's when that's when we got the voters' roll started. If you have moved, if you are not sure, if there has been a consolidation of your area where you vote, because remember when we started out, there weren't enough voting stations and you had to travel, and now there are much more voting stations. So just check where you are registered, and that is where you can show up to vote so that you can vote on all the right ballots. So,
I mean, there is an argument, and I'm kind of with Congo Chris on this one. The more complex the ballot, the better. It'll weed out the intellectually inept from the electorate. maybe it's a good thing that we have three ballot papers, and it'll confuse the hell out of really, really stupid people, and then they won't vote or they'll spoil their ballot, and then we can carry on with our lives and not have them partake. What do you think?
I don't know if I agree with that, yo. This is also where then what they will do is they will just vote for what they know. Then we're actually also just as hoist on our own petard, my friends, because again, People, I'm telling you, because it, the more confused people are, then they're just going to revert back to type, right? They're going to go, who did I vote for the last time? What is the one that I know? Of all of these pictures that I see, all of these names that I see, which is the one that I know best? Tick. And yeah, then...
I mean, someone was saying earlier in the comments, and I agree with this, and one of the reasons, just by the way, let me just clear this up too, because a lot of people are confused as to why we're doing this show live. One of the reasons we want to do this show live is because of the comments. it's an important part of what we do on a Thursday. We pre-recorded last week's episode. The Burning Platform is not going anywhere. It's here to stay. And we thought, well, we'll play it out at the same time. And then people complained that they couldn't comment. So we thought, okay, well, we'll do it live this week, which we're doing. Now, I see there's still some people in the comments who are complaining that they can't stream it on certain apps or whatever. Listen, we're trying. We're trying everything we can to make sure everybody's experience of this is as good as possible. We're even trying to get you the very best guests. And as I said, I was woken up to a message at 4 o'clock this morning that Zaki Ahmad, who we were going to talk to, mysteriously couldn't make it anymore. This was sent by his people at 11 o'clock last night. You know already on this show, we've brought you every single political leader with the exception of MK, the ANC, and the EFF. I know Songezo Zibi is somewhere in the mix still to come for one of the forthcoming shows. But otherwise, we brought you every other leader of every other party. They've all pitched up. They've all told us what they think. They've put themselves in front of the microphone and the cameras. And I think we want to make sure after this, you've got all the information you need. So you can go into that voting booth and put your mark down with confidence.
We are at least doing our bit. We know that all the Burning Platform people are going to do the right thing. We know you're going to do the right thing. You're not going to spoil your ballots. But there's a very important question here from Zandim Seleni, who's saying, what happens if an independent candidate gets 180,000 votes? Because at the moment, remember that the calculations are also, it's almost actuarial the way that they calculate these things, right? Because it's about the number of people that are contesting versus the number of people that eventually show up to vote and the number of votes that each one got. So in the unlikely event that an independent candidate gets 180,000 votes, they actually forfeit the other seats because they... Really? So do the smaller parties, by the way. So even the smaller parties, if you only have 20 people on your list that you send to the IEC, if you get more seats than just the 20 that you have, then that's it. You forfeit those seats. This was also one of the things that was highly contested with the changing over of the constitution and how this like proportional representation is going to work, the 200 seats versus the 400. And this has been... Look, it's the first time that we're doing it in this way, and I suppose there's going to be some niggling, but we're eventually going to get it right. Hey, Gareth, this is the one thing that we can know for sure. And last week, Gareth, that we spoke to Judge Krikler, who was the first chairperson of the IEC, said, you know, if we the one thing about the IEC is it's got competent people, it's got people who are wanting to do the right thing. And it's an uncompromised institution. So, and they want to get the right thing done.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, unfortunately, people just don't like change. And every election is going to be different. There's going to be no period in your life where, you know, two spaces within 5 years of each other are going to be exactly the same. So ballot papers will change. The rules will change. I mean, Judge Krikler, who... And we will play this out as a special on a podcast party at some point very, very soon. But Judge Krikler, of course, was the Constitutional Court Justice, also one of the men who managed to make some pretty impressive law on that first Constitutional Court. But in this case, talking to him as the IEC's first chair, he mentioned that he actually didn't think independents were a constitutional thing. He was a little disappointed that they allowed independents in. Which was something I didn't expect to hear that from him. I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, you know, this is always how I felt. But also, he also thought that having more people participating will help us also get a more professional parliament. Yeah. You know, because he did also speak about, because can you imagine in 1994 where so many people were going to get into parliament who had never been there. And we still have some of that to a large extent. And these are lawmakers. You know, this is a legislative body. These people are supposed to be lawmakers. We're building it as, you know, we're still a very, very young country. So and that is why more people participating within the system also raises the level of the kind of people that get in.
Now, speaking of more people influencing the system, KNA puts into the comments here that this is the first time the international vote will have an influence on the national vote so drastically. Apparently, and I mean, I'm not going to be able to fact check this immediately, KNA, so I'll believe you.
I can.
150,000 people are registered globally to vote who are not in South Africa in our elections. If that's true, that could be what, 3 seats? That's quite significant.
But remember that they only get, so their vote counts for almost like half, because they only vote national, right? So they don't get to vote provincial or any of those things. So that's the only thing. So Wayne, I'm just trying to look it up here, because I did see Wayne Sussman posting about this about a week ago. So I'm going to look for that.
I mean, that's quite a
significant. The numbers. The numbers were quite high. They were quite high, the number of people.
And a good thing it is, too, that we have all of those South Africans, because, I mean, many of them are only temporarily in other countries. Many of them are working overseas, studying overseas. They may be more vested in the future of this country than a lot of people who haven't even registered and who live here. You know, so that's an important consideration. Congo Chris says we should have some direct voting influence in the law as an electorate. In the US, they include propositions on the ballot separately to candidates. I would much rather vote for policies than parties. You know what, Congo Chris? This is a big deal. And I think to many of us, this is the kind of thing that would actually get us up off our backsides and make us go and vote. If you imagine like they could do 3 bouts in a year of propositions that you could vote on, whether it was provincially or nationally, let's say important things that the nation needs to decide on, where we can't rely on our representatives to do this for us because we don't trust them or because they don't have enough of a mandate from enough people. I wonder if it'd be worth us looking at voting 2-3 times a year on important propositions. I wonder how many people would go. Certainly, I think less people would go to those than would go and vote for people.
Gareth, the NHI was just signed into law yesterday. All the bills and proposals get to be open to inputs from all the stakeholders. How many people even know what's currently on that roll? How many people are showing up to give their personal input when they are consultative conferences around these things? How many people show up? People ain't gonna show up. People don't care. I mean, I think, you know, for you and I, Congo Chris, who are interested and who do read these things, and
they just want
things to work and to live their lives. Nobody is showing up for any of that.
Well, there we go. Pumi just sideswiped that idea from Congo Chris and me. So there it's gone now. The IEC actually works very well, says Mapelo, and I agree, especially since we've spent quite a lot of time with them in various shows that we've recorded. I called them the other day trying to help an older person. They answered within 5 seconds of the call, and I got help very quickly, and their website is very good. Well, you see, this is the kind of feedback that...
Their website is very good, guys. And so is their app, by the way, which, as you know, it's one of the things that I will stay awake all night watching after those voting stations close. It's wonderful. Their app works very well.
Yeah. Well, Congo Chris is just clapping back at you, saying at least it'll be a short voting queue, Pumi, if we do vote on politics. All right. Can I ask you something? So there have been a lot of developments in the last little while, and you and I have been speaking to a number of analysts trying to get our heads in the right place ahead of this. A lot of the analysts are talking about massive changes. Some, like Wayne Sussman, who we spoke to yesterday, and we probably will have to get on shortly and just ahead of the elections, say that actually the chances of major change are quite slim. Now, with the possible exception of MK, where everything is still shrouded in obscurity, and we're still not sure whether MK will even be able to make it across the line on election day because there's so much infighting and disastrous noise, turmoil within that party.
So So they're supposed to be holding a manifesto rally. Manifesto rally on Saturday at Orlando Stadium. So that will be an interesting one to watch. Can they fill Orlando Stadium?
And if they can't fill it, can they at least tell us who the people in their slate are? You know, people don't know because they keep firing and getting rid of people, and then their assassination attempts, and then they're hiring bodyguards for this and for that. I mean, it does sound like it's an absolute chaos at the moment. But what do you think, if anything, and you and Canton made some of these predictions the last time we spoke, what do you think the chances are of any party making a really good run for it and suddenly increasing their share in Parliament by a significant margin?
I don't see it. I don't see how. I really don't see how. I see, other than the new guys, who obviously this is their run for it, we'll see what they get because of the work that they've done. And over the past couple of weeks, there's been a real push and a real surge in some of the stuff. But I also think that the polls, you know my view, the polls get it wrong more than 50% of the time. Yeah. But I also think we are so concentrated on what we hear in mainstream media, what we see on social media, and we forget that that accounts for a very small part of our population. And I think that's part of why we get these things so wrong.
K&A just fact-checking himself. The number is
70. Yeah, I thought it was around 800,000.
All right, so not quite as many as you thought it was. All right, so
But it's a significant jump from 2019. It's a significant jump from the number of people who were registered in 2019. I think it's almost doubled, and which is indicative of two things. The number of people who've left the country as well, because that's what that is also about. And, you know, sad and worrying.
So, all right, I want to go to Patrick's comment here, which leads us on to really what is the big story of this week. And it all happened yesterday. There was a big ceremony. The president's never done this before for signing anything. But there was a big ceremony. There was a lot of fanfare. There was a lot of noise. He did it publicly. It was live streamed. It was like it was a big celebration, the NHI bill, which we'll get to in a minute. But Patrick says, the problem is we need drastic policy change. I'm sensing the unsustainability of the current trajectory, especially if one just looks at the finances of the country, e.g. tax base versus grants. We already know how it's unsustainable for us to keep paying some 16 to 20 million, depending on who you talk to, people on social grants. Low as that amount may be for each person, it's just not going to work for a tiny, tiny proportion of the tax base who are employed. A tiny proportion of the tax base who are paying income tax, a tiny proportion of the tax base who have the prospect of making more rather than less money in this economy. How are we going to pay for everything seems to be the big question. Now, we're not even getting to the NHI, but we're going to. What was yesterday's ceremony all about, if not electioneering?
It was about electioneering. Do you think that he got paid for it? Do you think there's an in contact ding ding? And then he was like, okay, let's sign. The money is true.
Who?
Because I feel like maybe it sounds like a conspiracy theory. So NHI is very similar to what they have in the UK, the NHS. And I don't think that we are that high a priority as a country for King Charles III to have as one of his first kind of head of state visits, Cyril Ramaphosa. I think Cyril was brought there to have a deep chat, to be kind of, you know, massaged into the NHI has got to happen because there's money to be made for a lot of people. There is money to be made. And I think the signing it in yesterday is a cheap political trick, very cheap.
Yeah,
as the news came out that he was signing it yesterday, on Tuesday night, I got an SMS from the DA campaign saying, we are the only ones that can stop the NHI.
I'm still not able to draw the dots here and connect them between why Cyril would have made such a big ceremony and a fuss about this if it wasn't just electioneering. And if someone, as you say, has been paid, who benefits from this? I mean, surely this is bad news for the medical aid companies, because now it's unclear exactly how we're going to operate going forward. He said, the president, and I paid as much attention as I absolutely had to here without getting too involved, but he said something to the effect of, what we're going to do now is manage public health better because the private sector has managed it bad. Something from the guy whose own health minister, during COVID, the greatest single health threat to the country in his administration, this guy was embezzling funds for websites and God knows what else. This is the guy who, it seems, has not built sufficient clinics and hospitals to take care of the people in this country as it is, even with as much of the budget that goes towards health as it currently does. This is the guy who can't seem to guarantee South Africans even the most basic health care. And now we're going to talk about making all care free. I mean, I saw a tweet by Jonathan Witt, who's, I think, fairly sensible on this issue. He said you can have accessibility, quality, and I think cost. You only have two of those at any given time, because you can't put a gun to a doctor's head and force them to work for a quarter of the money that they would have asked in the private sector. How are you going to get that right? How is this bill going to make it worthwhile for doctors to stay in this country?
So, you know, I mean, if I look at it in the NHS, and I told you guys about reading about kind of how the NHS was born in the UK through the McKinsey intervention. All those many months ago. And what a like unmitigated disaster it is in the UK.
Right.
It is going to be a train wreck. But I also think that there's so much, like a lot of things that happen here at home, there's so much fighting and pulling asunder that has made this thing something that it is not. It has made it about something that is not. We're always being pitted against each other. You know, it's against the middle class. It's against the taxpayers. It's against, you know, that's not what it is. You know, this thing is actually a money grab by few individuals, and the benchmark that they are using is a failing benchmark. And we are giving more control to a government that has failed at everything else, right? It just, ugh.
Well, I mean, here's like another.
I have that green face emoji right now.
Here's an interesting
green face emoji.
So apparently every single major medical association in South Africa is against the NHI, every one of them. And it's worth also looking at whether or not the doctors, who are the ones who we need the most in this system, actually might know something, because it seems that they've been ignored completely. It's like the government have got together with whoever they can find sucker with in the private sector, and they've got together with perhaps international agencies and consultancies in the form of, you know, McKinsey doing this with the NHS all those years ago. I'm horrified at that. The idea of letting McKinsey or Bain or any of those people anywhere near the administration of this country scares me more than letting Cyril Ramaphosa run it for the next 5 years.
Agents of the counter-revolutionary, Gareth.
Well, whatever it is, I'm just horrified that no one's talking to the only people that we should be talking to, and that is the doctors and the patients. Anyone who thinks government can do anything better than individuals is completely misled. Their own brain is letting them down. There's no other way to put it. There is no example of where this has worked better. Look at how badly BEE has been implemented. Despite the fact that it had almost universal support at the beginning, people were giving it a chance. Companies threw their entire will and volition behind the thing, and it's still an absolute unmitigated disaster, which has resulted in just a handful of people making tons and tons of money, and most Black people being in exactly the position they were in before BEE came along. This is a perfect example of what will happen.
Do you think that the NHI or implementation of the NHI going forward is going to get the same treatment from South Africans as the ETOLs got?
Well, I think about it this way, right? I have to you have to think of yourself, unfortunately. When the government fucks up as badly as it's likely to do in this scenario, you have to look to yourself. So you will look at you and your son, Pumi. I will look at me and perhaps my extended family. And I'll say,
and what is
the best way for us to seek, you know, really quality healthcare going forward in an emergency, whatever cases may arise? And I'm not so sure if the medical aid is going to throw its weight behind government's NHI plan that I want to be a part of that. I might just want to cancel that and start something else, maybe just save enough money that if horrible things happen to me along the way, I can be insured in some way against what might occur. You never know what could happen, but I certainly don't think you can trust the people who are trusting government.
So with blue sky thinking, what I hope happens next is that this opens a loophole for lots of young new doctors to find a way to work with this crazy system to create more opportunities for themselves and hopefully more spaces for more patients. Because currently, so we do agree, I think, that currently the system doesn't work. Doesn't work in private, it doesn't work in public. I think it's crazy that there are three medical aids, really, that one can go to. And most of the time, they're trying not to pay your claims. Even the top ones, you know, you can be on the, I'm paying 20,000 Rand for my family on this medical aid. And when you need them to pay, then you have, no, we don't, we only pay this rate. And then you have a co-payment. So I think that is that the people have been shortchanged because that's a cabal that's working. And there was, by the Competition Commission, I think in 2020, a report around this medical marketplace and how much collusion is happening in there. So I think the people have been shortchanged in that respect. I think the public sector could be run better. I think that there are hundreds of young doctors coming out of medical school that are not being placed. And so the hospitals, and we've spoken with this, with what's his name on here as well, they are understaffed hospitals and they are unemployed doctors. In what world? In what world? You know, well, there's a skills mismatch because it's not being managed properly.
To answer your question on whether we could resist this with civil disobedience.
Carl, I did not say that private healthcare doesn't work. I said it doesn't work for the pockets of the people. Because if you are paying 3,000 Rand or 20,000 Rand for your medical aid every month, and then they still say to you, oh no, it's not enough for you to cover this particular practitioner. That's bullshit.
So Jonathan says here, Dr. Witt says, unfortunately, e-tolls required you to buy into the system. NHI, though, happens from the top down. There will be no way to resist, just as everyone pays taxes, because PAYE. So they're just going to take it straight out of what you already eke. So think of this, rather than worrying about the healthcare part of it, everybody, because that does sound complicated. And Pumi and I are going to talk ourselves into circles if we do this, because neither of us are necessarily expert in this. Rather think of it as another tax. That's all it is. So take whatever it is you're paying at the moment and add another 10 to 15%. That is what's happening to you. They found another way to steal what is not theirs. That's what's going on. Forget about how the healthcare comes about on the other side, because you know what? You're on your own anyway. Here's what's going to happen. They're going to take an extra piece of the pie that isn't theirs at gunpoint, and you're just going to have to hand it over. That is what it is. All tax is theft, and this in particular is a horrible kind of theft. This is a horrible kind of theft because it comes at the expense of your health. So however this results for you, I'm terribly sorry. There are going to be a whole lot of people who are going to be standing in queues in government hospitals till kingdom come, or until they die, whichever comes first. And in the meantime, you will also have to pay for the privilege of waiting around and probably getting shoddy healthcare. So there we are. Hand over more of your money. That's the important part of this, not what happens afterwards. Am I wrong?
So we literally have like 3 minutes to go, and I want to ask you this. Do you care about a burning CGI flag?
Not at all. Talk about performative electioneering. I think that the 20 people on social media who stoked up that fire are the flag burners themselves. I cannot believe, and I heard this come up in some town hall meeting that I stumbled upon on TV the other day. I cannot believe that there are people immature and stupid enough not to understand that things can be metaphors and similes, that there are such things as innuendos, that there are ironies, that a flag being burnt is not always a sign of high treason, that in most free countries, you are allowed to burn the flag as a form of protest. And furthermore, that this should be the thing that gets your goat, that you're not pissed off about things like your healthcare being compromised, that you're not upset about potholes, electricity, water, people dying, people being uneducated, people not getting jobs, but you'll get upset about a flag? Bullshit. I don't believe you. You are a performer and a liar, and I don't believe you.
Well, I do think that the performance, Gareth, the performance. I was, and because we spoke a little bit about the electioneering and how much or how little of it there has been as compared to previous years, it's been fascinating for me to see everybody's TV ad is out now. Everybody's TV ad is out.
By the way, the SABC, by the way, refused to pay.
Everybody that's going to have a TV ad has their TV ad out with just like 13 days to go. And then for this squabble to dominate for at least 2 days, 2 days in the news cycle is a long time. And Wayne made a very interesting point yesterday about the fact that what we haven't heard enough of in this campaign season is we have not heard enough about, and we've spoken to a whole lot of people on here, but everywhere else, they haven't spoken about their policies, not enough about unemployment, not enough about the economy, not enough about even healthcare. But woo, the fight about a burning flag. Yay.
Okay. So the SABC has refused to play the DA's ad. They say that, you know, we have principle. We're not going to play this. Ask yourself who it benefits to not talk about the real issues. Ask yourself which party is sitting around going, oh, thank God the DA made this ad and we can make a fuss of it so that stupid people will get upset rather than pay attention to how badly we're running things. Ask yourself, because the answer is very simple. I almost want to do, and luckily my days of just looking for trouble for no good reason are over, but I almost want to just go somewhere very public and just set fire to a flag and see what happens. Because I promise you, like, nothing will, right? Nothing will. Because these people who are so upset by this TV ad aren't really upset. And these are people who lie about everything in their lives. They're not people who you can ever take seriously. And in fact, if you saw people on your timeline on social media getting properly upset about an ad in which a CGI flag is burnt, which is a metaphor for what that party is saying another party has done to the country, then you must block them from your timeline because you're following stupid people.
And again, all it did for me was emphasize how much noise the timeline has that what's happened. It's all it's done is it's emphasized for me how much noise the timeline has. And I wondered how many people outside of the timeline are even like talking about this, have seen it or even care, you know?
I was trying to correct Mo Dollars here in the comments. Mo Dollars says you can't burn the American flag, liar. Well, first of all, you can. Actually, it's a First Amendment protected right that if you want to protest the American government, you can burn the American flag. And people have, and people do. In fact, you can find examples of this just from, I don't know, a couple of days ago at pro-Palestinian rallies, there were people burning American flags. If you want to go a little bit further back, 2020 George Floyd riots, you can find people burning American flags. You can find hippies in the 60s burning American flags who were protesting the war in Vietnam. So no, I'm not a liar, Mo, and get your facts straight and start paying attention because you're one of those people who probably get upset about this one.
What performance are we talking about right now?
So, yeah, Mo Rabbit says the Moosey performance was seriously cringe. What a twat waffle. I don't know. Was Moosey one of the people who got upset? Probably.
Well, now half the comments have got flames and flags. Guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
The and good by news the way, we're not going to ban your comments.
We're not going to ban your comments. And we also don't mind if you burn things as long as you don't, you know, burn it right in front of us. We don't want to smell it necessarily. And there we go. Witt's with me on this one. SCOTUS, that's the Supreme Court of the United States, also ruled that you can burn the American flag. You can go and read Justice Scalia, who's a very conservative justice on exactly that. Yonda says, Pumi, you're actually wrong. Check all the ads the DA has done. They're factual based about their plans and policy. You're focusing on the wrong issues and dribbled. The ANC is offended by burning a CGI flag, but not a burnt down parliament building, says Congo Chris. Also, irony of ironies, right?
Yonda, did you see Africa Check about the DA's Jobs Act ad? That's my last thing. Check it out. It'll be fascinating reading.
Well, David Sachs says, hey, from Sydney, nice to catch you live instead of on the podcast. Well, it's nice of you to join us live. And this is what we want to do.
Just in time for us to say goodbye.
Yeah, I mean, going forward, though, we may very well want to do this Burning Platform live on a Thursday. Let us know if that's what you want so we can make it work for you. Drop in the comment section and let us know what you're up to. And at the same time, we want to hear from you. If you want to email us, you can do that too. All of this will be on the podcast.
If people are interested, we're doing a little dipstick to check if people are interested in coming to live events. Please drop an email to Podcast Party.
Good idea.
And let us know if you would come to a live event, if we had a live Burning Platform event.
We will make sure that we put the email address in the comments. And you can obviously go to the website. We're all on social media too. If you go to my timeline, you'll see Burning Platforms right at the top, and you'll be able to send an email to the address that we'll attach to that. Thanks, everybody. We will see you tomorrow on my show, and otherwise back here in a week's time with only a couple of days tick-tock until the election. Dun, dun, dun. It's all happening. Thank you, Pums.
Thank you, Gareth. I missed you and your coffee here in the studio this morning. Contact at podcastparty.co.za. That's the email address.
There we go.
Contact at podcastparty.co.za.
Very good. Thanks, Poems. We'll see you next week.